Sirius XM Radio.
Surprise, surprise. So you rubbed your eyes. Never knew you'd yes, so cool as eyes. Hit a bite, then built a stupefy. Ducks categorizes as hard cries. That's a lie, we know why we're occupiers. No words but up to your style, and these are higher. Profiles are low as soon as we go. As a three straight from a deeper shade of soul. Deeper
shade of soul. We're back at the races. Little past top of the hour on this Wednesday, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale. Sid Fernando joining us from the BK. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. you gotta wear the Kevlar, Sid, on a daily basis. You need Kevlar, you need asbestos overcoats and everything else. It is, I'll tell you, it's not easy. You got to be ready to do battle on a daily basis.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of various fronts are being questioned daily.
Well, maybe one thing that should serve as a reminder was 350 million dollars worth of commerce. That's usually something in this country that carries some weight with it.
Obviously, the sales are prospering. I think what was it, 364, 54, or something like that.
Yeah.
A little below last, I think 4.5% less than last year, according to, I think I remember the figures in the TDN, but pretty darn good sale.
$360 million, and there were certain things about it that I'd love your analysis. I read the pieces by Chris McGrath has been really churning out post sale analysis and from a couple different perspectives, both the genetic issues and questions as well as the commerce, and there's no doubt that we didn't need this sale to confirm the top end. The question is, Sid, is there as much vitality beyond the top layers? And one thing that is of concern is you get the sense that the rich are consistently getting richer. And what's your reaction to that?
Well, I think first of all, has done a good job on his sale analysis. I kind of addressed that issue by juxtaposing 8.3
Sid, let me jump in. Your phone has given us trouble here
really?
So far. Yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Better, yeah. But you've gone in and out several times already. If there's a better spot or I don't know.
Let me try it again. Move around.
No, you're good. You're good right now, but it just as soon as it stabilizes, then it sort of distorts and fades for a second as well.
Let me try and speak again.
All right, you're good there.
from here.
No. Yeah. Jesus.
Can you hear me, Steve?
Yeah. Yeah, I gotcha. I not sure if it's location or connection because, see how you go. Give it a shot.
All right, let me give this a shot. If not, I'll try something else.
All right.
I think Chris juxtaposed it pretty well with the 8.2 million horse versus the last horse that sold for $1,300. You know, the first book was so great, and it carried into the second book and the third book. But, you know, the reality, Steve, is that when you get to the last couple of books, especially the last two sessions, you're always going to get a big drop-off in price. That session and those sessions at the lower end of the book do paint a story of how difficult it is to breed horses in general if they don't tick all the boxes. Most horses don't. So I think to answer your question, I'm part of the business is not really as healthy as one would like, and that's symptomatic of racing in general, as we've talked about on your show over the years. The tracks versus larger tracks, and it's really getting to the point where the game is really all about what happens at the bigger tracks, and likewise in the bloodstock business, it's centered around your most expensive horses, which tend to be your best formed and best pedigreed horses.
The note that McGrath also made about how the Saratoga, how the phasing, the preliminary phasing sales, the July sale and the two Saratoga sales have been a really accurate bellwether for what to expect at Keeneland as well. And, you know, more than just, oh, you know, there's lots of activity and there's lots of high end. It actually reflected even like the reduction in median was down 10%. And that was even reflected in the three phasic sales as well. I suppose, though, at the same time, Sid, when we then get down the road and we talk about, as we do very often, you know, some of the horses that were purchased for, you know, modest sums for from 50 to 150 or even less. I mean, the 25 to 100. And you know, those become you get stake winners. I haven't ever seen necessarily a sale chart that that distills brackets of expense versus the number of stake winners. But that would be interesting. I mean, how many stake winners come out of $100,000 yearlings? How many come from 100 to 250, 250 to 5? You know, 5 to 750 and 750 and up. Hope springs eternal, and there's plenty of evidence. I mean, look at what happened in Pennsylvania. Another horse out of that 16 maiden claimer. I mean, you can't make it up.
Yeah, and you know, when you're talking about price, it doesn't preclude those cheaper horses, as you point out, from becoming good winners. And to use your point about Pennsylvania, the two grade one winners were essentially sired by horses standing for $5,000. Algorithms, $5,000 at Claiborne. is the sire of Math Wizard, and the Larry Jones was hired by Istan, who's actually in Saudi Arabia right now. And he was at Airdrie Stud, and he was standing for like 5,000 at the end before he left. So, by the way, just across the pond, the G2 Mill Reef Stakes, also this weekend, won by a horse called Pierre Lapin, and his sire stands for 4,000 euros. So, you know, it's, again, the price is not a relative, in my opinion, and you know, as you said, there are so many exceptions to this. It's not really a linear, it may be, but it's not uniformly indicative of quality. And you know, we're anecdotally, I'm giving you 2-3 examples just this weekend, but there are a lot of examples like that. So it does give everybody hope. And I think, you know, as Chris wrote that article, you know, he kind of pointed out that, well, that's what they sold for, but let's see what happens when you put a saddle on them and what happens to the 8.2 million horse versus the $1,300 horse. Kind of a allusion to, you really never can tell until you get them to the track, because it's not always, the track is not about, it's not a beauty pageant. It's not about the best looking always winning. There's so many horses throughout the game have been imperfect, have been horses that have had issues here or there. You know, you take a horse like Forgo, who was a homebred for Lazy F Ranch, but he didn't race at 2. He had all sorts of congenital leg defects, and he was a huge horse, and he ran through a lot of problems. On the other end of the spectrum, you take a horse, another gelding like John Henry, a very small horse, obscure pedigree, old Bob Bowers, and, you know, he eventually found his métier on the turf and became one of the greats. And again, unforeseen, but that's what happens. That's what this game is about. It's the rare horse that's that physical standout, like a Justify, who runs to it. And even in Justify's case, Steve, he had a veterinary issue that made a lot of people pass on him, even though the eventual paid $500,000. He may have brought more, believe it or not, if not for a veterinary issue.
Now, that part of it is what makes it is what makes it so fascinating and you know, mysterious. Is the you know, the genetic equation and the mental makeup, and you know, who's handling the horse from, you know, the time they, you know, they leave sales rings, and you know, whether it's
the environmental effect of it. Yeah,
exactly. And you know, that's been a very, you know, very furtive topic actually for you guys at TDN. And then in fact, you know, you wrote that column the other day about oddballs, and it really fits some of the things that we talk about and that I love noting in pedigrees. When you find, you know, when you find somebody that is obscure and provides, you know, that has historically provided you know, some sort of a boost to pedigrees. And Chris wrote about it as well. And then I'd love that that Rob Whiteley sat down the last day or two and responded. And Rob's got a great letter to the editor reinforcing what you and Chris wrote about this week.
He does. The only point that I took issue with his letter is where he talked about, you know, a preoccupation. We talked about sire lines and whatnot. Then he got into the issue of Knicks and said, well, you know, Knicks should also incorporate females and whatnot. Now, historically, the term Knicks has always been about a sire line cross, which is, you know, a sire with a broodmare sire. It's an indication of if those crosses work. It's been used from breeders from the beginning of time. You know, the famous one that started at Clay is Nashville and his son Bold Ruler with Prince Quillo. Prince Quillo mares, or Prince Quillo line mares. Secretariat, for example, is an example of that. Bold Ruler out of Something Royal by Prince Quillo. The great European horse Mill Reef, U.S. bred by Paul Mellon, is an example of that. He was by Never Bend, the son of Nash Rule, out of Milan Mill by Prince Quillo. You have those types of pedigrees, and then people tend to copy those things. So when you get the Seattle Slough, he's a Bold Ruler line horse, the mare by Poker, who's the son of Round Table, the son of Prince Quillo. So that's what a Nick is. It's not a big deal. It's what we use. It's what people copy. To tie it in Chris's article and Rob's commentary about mares and the fact that they're not, you know, one complaint people don't talk about mares, and well, mares have much less foals. It's, if Rob was critiquing Knicks by saying that there's such a small population to base it on, well, imagine if you use mares. Stallions breed so many more, get so many, much more progeny than mares. If you just use mares alone, your sample size decreases that much more. And you and I were talking about a mare that had 16 foals the other day. Well, you know, Leslie's Late, if you look at her, her foals, you can slice it and dice it however you want. If you talk about a Nick with a mare, that particular mare has been bred from top stallions, and her three best horses, I think there are only three stakes winners, are all by Stormcat line sires.
Hmm.
You can go back and talk about everything in her pedigree, and sure, but the results that she's had are all Stormcat line sires. Beholder, Mendelssohn, and Into Mischief. Okay? Her other folders. So maybe that's a mare nick. That mare specifically nicking with, if Rob wants to talk about mare nick, well, maybe that there's one. There's another famous case. I happened to meet Arthur Seligson's daughter, Ramona Bass, at the Keeneland sale. And Seligson famously had a mare named Brown Berry, who was the dam of his classic winner, Avatar, who stood at Claiborne. And Avatar was a Rebel line stakes winner by Grouse Stark. But once you start looking at Brown Berry's best runners, you'll notice that they're all by Rebel line, or most of them are by Rebel line stallions, including Hours After by Alleged, who was a French Derby winner. So, take another one, by the way. Dee. Okay, famous mare. She had 18 foals. if you look at all her folks, her primary stakes winners are Raise a Native, Line, Courses, Althea, Native Courier. There's a couple by Al Hattab, but none of the other ones panned out. So there's an example of a mare with Nick, but unfortunately, you don't find that out till the very end because you have how they produce. And by the time it's come to the end, it's really not worth it. Getting back to Leslie's Lady, after she's produced three stakes winners by Stormcat Lion Horses, she's bred to American Pharoah, and that particular horse that made $8.2 million, she's worked at it, you know, for some people as a brood mare alone. She doesn't even have to do anything. She's a half to three, you know, top grade one winners. All of this stuff, you know, it's this information is out there, and it's how people parse it, Steve, and how you come to conclusions based on your own information bias of how things should be.
Something Royal was what, 18 when she had Secretariat?
Yeah, and she'd already had Sir Gaylord beforehand.
That's right, quite a while beforehand.
Yeah, I think so. Can't remember quite.
Got it, 61, 60, yeah, 60, they're early 60s, so probably 10, maybe 10 years earlier. That's one of those, that's another, in fact, McGrath talked about that too. It's funny, I thought of you for so many different reasons reading that piece, because McGrath also used, he didn't use the NFL terminology, the Mr. Irrelevant, but he used that sort of template, right? The first round draft pick, number one in the draft, if you go by dollars and cents, the $8 million versus the last horse through the ring.
Right.
It was a Haynesfield filly, and he juxtaposed it, and I got a big kick out of that. That was the basis of the piece. Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah. And have you been hearing what I've been saying?
Absolutely. No, it was good. It was good. Okay. It's been much better since whatever you did has helped, and it's been stable. The reference you made, I want to hit a couple of the other things that there were so many things coming out of the sale, as well as, out of the results on the racetrack. And you mentioned Algorithms, and in addition to the Pennsylvania Derby winner, Algorithms had a second winner. What is a win like this? The grade ones, the sires are always looking for them, and aspiring horses and colts are looking for grade ones to even get a chance at stud. What does this do for Algorithms? I mean, how impactful is a win like this?
If it had come to his first crop, it would have been huge. He's standing for 5,000 now. You know, it's not going to really move the needle too much. Unfortunately, that's how this game is. You know, he may pick up some extra mares and stuff, but, it's all based on if they hit early, because then that's what drives, mares to that horse. If they've hit one, down the line, people say, yeah, sure, we'll think about that horse. But it's not going to, maybe he'll get a bump in stud fee. I don't know. But I doubt, it's not something that's going to be a magnet to in top mares to him, obviously.
you can't write these scripts. They just write themselves. You mentioned the multi-crop factor too. That also came up in these pieces to a degree. And one of McGrath's conclusions was the industry, from the breeding standpoint, being too quick to judge sires. And I keep referencing, and Steve Haskin brings it up when this topic rolls around, John Nayrud's admonishment that you can't make a decision, you shouldn't make a decision about a stallion's productivity and proclivity until seven crops have been produced. That's the number that Nayrud, would trumpet.
Yeah, and the reality is that Nayrud was talking in a different era when people were breeding horses to race. When you're breeding to sell, and the sellers and the stallion owners and everybody become the focal point. So if they don't hit with that first crop, Steve, you're absolutely sunk. And you get people don't breed your stallion. So how do you give them a chance when nobody is breeding? And the reason people aren't breeding is because they're sellers and they realize if I breed to that horse, I'm not going to be able to sell a foal. So they don't go to that horse. That's what happened with New Year's Day. If Maximum Security had come from his first crop instead of his second, it would have been a different story. He came from his second crop, and he came as a second crop 3-year-old and not a second crop 2-year-old either. So you had this big gap, and at this time, people had just stopped breeding to the horse. It happens. He's one of many examples, and it's exactly what these guys are writing about. And they're expressing indignation without understanding that it's the climate. The breeding is just a reflection of the climate. The climate is to sell. So you go, you front load new horses in your programs to breed to them because you can sell them right away. People don't want to breed to a horse in their third or fourth crops because that horse could be a bust commercially, which leaves them also as sellers in a really bad predicament. So that's one of the reasons why it's the way it is right now. It's based on this marketplace, and it's based on selling. And as a matter of fact, I was talking to a client yesterday, and I said, look, I might as well say it because people are going to know who he is, Chuck 50. I said, look, Chuck, you're like a throwback, because you're like one of the last guys that breeds to race anymore. Okay. Even the Phippses now are selling their colts. And they were the last of longtime great golden age owner breeders. Everybody's more interested in selling now. And it's not effective for people to breed. And breed and race, that is. And it's how the industry has developed organically to this point. It's become more money-making oriented and less about that prestige of owning your own horses and breeding and that interest that people had in doing that. And plus, the cost is so prohibitive. So that's first two crops, and
yeah. Well, this time, not only Sid, are you there? I think we lost Sid.
Yeah.
You are there.
I'm
okay,
here.
I thought this time we lost you for good. I thought that there was a drop off and there was nothing. This makes, this is an equation that, that we've talked about plenty of times, and there. I know that there's people that come into the business and are willing to, you know, acquire mares and build a broodmare band. And the question is, are their motivations strictly commercial, or you think about somebody like a Bob Edwards. There's somebody, and you know, you compare what he's doing and Jeff Bloom. I mean, Jeff is going to, you know, sell a Midnight Bisou, knowing that, you know, that there's going to be collectors and there's going to be a Mandy Pope, a Jane Lyon that is going to be interested. I mean, how do you foster more, you know, more Bob Edwards? I had this. He came to mind because we had that discussion. I think it was after the Del Mar. I think it was after the Del Mar Breeders' Cup with New Money Honey, and you know, I asked him, "Are you breeding at all?" And he said, "Well, we've got two mares that, you know, that with nice pedigrees that didn't make it to the races, and we're going to breed them." I mean, how do you foster that and try to swing the pendulum? You're not going to swing the pendulum back, and you know, you can't necessarily, you know, create Live Oaks and Charlotte Weber's, you know, you can't conjure them up, but
yeah.
You know, what do you do to try to balance the scales to some degree?
That's a good question. I think it wasn't just specific, Steve, to the top end of the market. It was a philosophy that actually went from the top all the way to the bottom. So you might have had Paul Mellon's Rokeby. You might have had Green Tree Stud, Darby Dan at the top, you know, people like that. But at the bottom, regional programs, you had plenty of people who were imitating the same thing. And there was a big outfit in South Carolina called O.H. Weanges and Son. They used to breed and race them in South Carolina and race them in New England at Rockingham and Suffolk Downs. They had their own stallions, their own mares. They'd breed everything, ship them up, and race them up in New England. In the Midwest, you had John B. the Hondo Ranch. Small-time outfit in terms of quality, but a big home breeder. You had breeders like that all over the place. It was part of what was done. There was a restaurateur named Bob Beal in Maryland, Robert Beal, who had a restaurant, and he actually, that was his business, but he had a stallion by the name of Friend's Choice. And he had a mare. I think her name was Duke's Tina. He bred the two, backyard breeder, and he got a colt by the name of Dave's Friend. You might remember him.
Sure,
became a big famous horse in Maryland, and was later sold to John Franks, who raced him. But Bob Beal started off, bred him, raced him himself, trained him himself too, I believe, before he sold him. But, you know, it was part of that ethos of people had with the horse. The horse was, you know, part of the culture of these people. They had the land. They had the pride in developing their own stallions and the mares. It didn't matter at what level it was. And over time, that model, whether it was, like I said, at the top end of the game or at the bottom, it kind of deteriorated with time, and it's replaced by people interested in return on investment. They love the glamour of the Derby, so for them, there's that lure of that. They love, but there are newer people, and some of them are going to breed, but the return investment at every level has become the pervading element. Then the sporting nature of it, and so you start to get more sportsmen involved, you're not going to change paradigm. And with the climate that we have right now, where racing is being absolutely hammered, I wonder how Sue Janney and guys at the Jockey Club actually handle this in cocktail parties when they go there and people are talking about, you're really involved in a nasty industry, aren't you? Well, basically, that perception is not going to draw sporting people to this game like it once did. You know. And so if you ask me how you're going to change that paradigm, I don't know. How are you going to change it to get more people as owners and breeders? I really don't know. Now, this paradigm exists outside the United States more, but even there it's changing too. In Europe, yeah, you know, you still have people doing it.
Yeah. I don't... That's all the whole separate. We can have that conversation. The reality is the people that were the bulwark of the industry, they came from dirty from you know plenty of dirty industries themselves. It's not as if you know.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
What was going on in those cocktail parties?
Yeah.
You know, I don't. I just.
But I'm talking about even at the lower level, Steve. It's just
I know.
Take that element out. Just there was an interest in the horse, and that kind of I see as I monitor the lower levels very closely as well, and I don't see that more. People got wiped out anyway after 2007 at the bottom half, got more wiped out than people realized. And, you know, those people that have land, that have a history with the horse, that you know, it became economically not feasible. And I think that economic feasibility is a major part of it as well.
Yeah. Now, I've said this many times. We've heard from, and I'll invoke Charlotte as an example. I mean, when people like a Charlotte Weber or a Seth Klarman, when they explain when the topic comes up that you know you can't just open a vein and lose. You know, they lose $6 million, $8 million a year and just let it spill on the floor. When the occasion arises to have a stallion, I see the ridiculous carrying on from people. Oh, this one, oh, how could they send this horse to stud? Yeah, they send it to stud because it they have to take money off the table. They can't just light money on fire. You have to get every so often you need something to come back to justify what you're spending and the fact that you know the fact that the cacophony about you know, stallions going to stud. I don't understand that.
Yeah, I mean that's the goal.
Yeah,
I mean, the goal is to try to cash out by getting a stallion prospect. I mean, you know, if you don't have that at the end of the, you know, at your business plan, I mean, you know, it's not very feasible economically. Is it?
Exactly.
I
mean, no.
Yeah.
No. I mean, once in a while, you know, here and when you get one, you have to take advantage. Well, Sid, there's so much more, but we're going to talk. You know, speaking of people that are involved in both ends of the game, Michael Stinson is going to join us. And earlier this morning, we talked to Joel Marr, who trained and developed Pepper's Pride. Michael had bought into her as a broodmare, and he had a fascinating example of what it's like to be in the business, considering that on Friday afternoon he gets word from TaylorMade that Pepper had to be put down because of laminitis, and then 24 hours later he's standing there at Philadelphia when King Jack earns him his first graded stake win. So there's the game in a nutshell.
That's a really good retelling of the vagaries of the sport, isn't it? Because his wife, who I met last year at the Breeders' Cup, Linda, really super talented sculptor, did that Julie Crone piece, as well as Pepper's Pride. Really nice people. It's great to see them getting in. Very modest in their outlook, and it's nice to see people like that have some success.
Well, they've got a number of other really nice horses in the pipeline, and of course Tom McGreevy doing the selection for the Stinsons, and it was really, really nice to be there to see them win their first stake. Michael Stinson joins us next. Meanwhile, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus. It's brought to you by Hill & Dale, and with every passing week, we're getting closer to the breeding season, and you need to get a hold of Sid. Work Thoroughbred Consultants, 510-490-1111. That number again, 510-490-1111, and follow Sid on Twitter, follow Sire Watch, and of course over at Hill & Dale. John Secure now with the sale over. We got to get to John and get some thoughts from him, and get his recap as well, and get a hold of Jared Burdine to make arrangements too. If you already know that you're going to have a Hill & Dale stallion service your mare, and don't forget, Sid needs to hear from you if you want to register. Speaking of stallions, get your stallion into the Enix system and get out ahead of that, because people are poking around and doing the nickings. And if your stallion, your new stallion's not in, then you're not getting the advantage of what the system is spitting out. Sid Fernando, everybody. Let's take a break, and we'll come back and have Michael Stinson join us. Then we got John White. Start looking at that Friday card at Santa Anita. And Seth Merrow. A little bit less than half the show remains. A good hour and 15 minutes. I'm going to head down to Belmont, and I'm going to go right up to Andy and say, look, I'm right here. I'm here at Belmont. Back after this at the races, Sirius XM.
Latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Hey, what's going on? Mikey here, and I'm going to tell you about an offer from my good friends at ExpressBet. Let's be honest. We know you love playing the races, but you can't always make it to the track. Sometimes life just gets in the way of a good bet. Well, what if I told you about a place where you never miss a bet and you start with house money? You'd say I'm crazy, right? Well, not at ExpressBet. Your first $100 are on them. That's right. Sign up with ExpressBet.com using promo code XBRadio, bet $100, and they'll deposit $100 back into your account the very next day. Hey, plus you could get an extra $25 if you use Express Fund Direct Deposit. You see what I mean? House money for betting the races. It's that easy. Check it out at ExpressBet.com to learn more. And don't forget to sign up for promo code XBRadio. You're gonna love it. And that's a Mikey guarantee. Must be 18 years or older and 21 years old in certain states to open an account with ExpressBet and reside in a state where such activity is legal. Void or prohibited. National Gambling Support Line, 800-522-4700.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Old friends, including the great champions that inspired unforgettable memories, and maybe even let you cash a ticket or two over the years. We even have a former child prodigy.
Here is a superstar. That horse's name is Afternoon Delights, and Kent the Sormon Afternoon Delights absolutely galloping in the Hollywood Futurities.
These are the champions that help out the horses that might not have won a Grade 1 race, but always tried just as hard. Come visit them all at Old Friends when you're in Kentucky or at our Bobby Frankel division, Old Friends in Saratoga. I know they'll be glad to see you. Go to oldfriendsequine.org or call us at 502-863-1775.
With Steve Vick on SiriusXM Radio.
Under the island, middle of a mountain, there is a big bad boom system. Blowing speakers, woofers and tweeters, amplifiers, melted wires. The party's exploded, chorus corroded, underground the Puget Sound.
We're back at the races, a little less than 15 to the top of the hour. At the races at the show started this morning after the first break with a visit from Joel Marr, and we talked about Pepper's Pride. And even before we got to Joel, I wanted this week to have Michael Stinson join us on the occasion of Saturday's graded stake win in the Gallant Bob by King Jack. And it was a great moment. And at the time when I was with the Stinsons and Tom McGreevy and Jerry Hollendorfer and everybody post-race, I was not aware that Pepper had been euthanized the day before. And so as Michael Stinson joins us, Michael, I what a swing of emotion from Friday afternoon to Saturday. Good morning, and I'm sorry, and congratulations.
Well, thanks, Steve. It was a swing of emotions. It was... you know, it was a difficult, as I'm sure when you visited with Joel, as he told you, it was a difficult decision for Joe Allen, particularly Joe Allen, to make. You know, he bred and raised and campaigned Pepper's Pride, and so, you know, she was family to him, and she was really special to everyone that had followed her, So it was just a real difficult decision. But you reach a point where you have to make the decision that you feel is best for the horse. And so we got to that point last week, unfortunately.
And then you're in Philadelphia for King Jack's try in the Gallant Bob, and 24 hours later, it's the high of the highs. It's really the game. If that isn't a snapshot of what this is like being involved in this sport, I don't know what is.
Well, it is. It's, you know, anyone that's been around the sport knows that it's, you know, there are a lot more lows, unfortunately, than there are highs. I guess if you win 20% of your races, you're lucky. And so, but you know, it was literally the highest of highs and lowest of lows last week. But it unfortunately goes with the game, and it's a kind of a microcosm of life, frankly.
That's very true, and it's one of the things about the sport that it is hard for outsiders to understand, and then when people get involved, no matter how successful they are, we talk about this a lot. No matter how somebody, you know, made their living, or you know, no matter how successful they are at whatever they do, it doesn't guarantee coming into this game and doing well either. And some people get, you know, very frustrated at that.
Well, it's you know, one of the terrific things I think about the sport, and it goes back many, many years, is I think it's one of the great melting pots in the world. I mean, you see such diversity of terrific people. You know, I'm a big fan of the folks on the backside of the racetrack. I think the folks that care for these horses on a day-to-day basis, they live with them. It's their life. It's 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And so I think the human interest aspect of the sport is something that really we could do a better job of communicating to the non-racing public about what's involved with the way these people commit their lives to these horses. And these horses become family. That's like with Pepper's Pride. You know, I bought an interest in her in 2009 after I had watched her, because I'm a Texas New Mexico guy, so I had watched her campaign, and she was just a phenom. You know, I don't care where you are when you win 19 out of 19 races. I don't care if it's a match race in Boise, Idaho. I mean that's getting something done, and she was so phenomenal that I followed her career, and then Joe and I had actually partnered in some horses prior to my buying an interest in her. And I just felt it was always just a great privilege to be associated with her. And she had such a presence about her. My wife is a sculptor, and she sculpted Pepper's Pride not long after we bought an interest in her. And she made the comment when she was in Kentucky, she spent about 2 days measuring and photographing her, and she was so smart. She would allow Linda to get calipers up around her eyes. She would never move. She was just a very, very special horse, and so it was a tough deal last week.
Well, and my chance to get to know Linda was at the unveiling of the beautiful bronze she did of Julie Crone, and when I asked about, you know, some of the origins of the interest and, you know, knowing that you were involved with Pepper and then, you know, the fact that, you know, Linda talked about the sculpture of Pepper, I've been really kind of rooting along with you subsequently. And there's actually, you know, a few tangential elements to this. One is, you know, you getting involved with McGreevy and having Tom come in and more or less, Mike, to put the spurs, I think, to your, you know, to your program. Talk about the evolution of your interest in the game and, you know, what feels like the cusp of a lot of success.
Well, you know, we've been, as I think I've mentioned to you, we've owned horses for 45 years or so, and primarily run in the Southwest, and so it's been, you know, I grew up around it in the Southwest, and so we've run horses for, you know, for a number of years, and of course, as I think I mentioned to you, I had, like so many people, I followed Tom McGreevy's career over the years, he's truly a special guy. He's just wonderful human being, but he also, in my opinion, is a savant like talent as far as his eye for a horse and his sense about what makes a good horse. So at any rate, you know, when Tom became available, we had met him actually. My family and I had met him at the Breeders' Cup the previous year, which is 3 years ago, I guess now. And so we'd met him and had a chance to visit. And so I knew that for me, that if I was ever going to have an opportunity to participate at kind of the next, you know, at the higher level, that the only way I could do it was with someone like Tom to select the horses. I mean, I, you know, as the great Mattress Mack said, I couldn't pick a good horse out of a pen full of chihuahuas, you know. So it's pretty important to know what you can do and what you can't do. And I got a lot of shortcomings, and I'm pretty aware of them. So Tom and I visited and really came together on a deal pretty quickly. And so, you know, we've not had a lot of success. We've had some, as you do in this business. I mean, you have setbacks and you have delays and so forth. But he's just a very special guy. I feel very lucky to be partnering with him, and we'll see, you know, where things go from here.
Well, the first graded stake domino to fall came on Saturday with King Jack, and you know there's a few other horses we'll talk about, but this is the one that you know that gets the first first race with a number attached to it, and there's obviously a lot of upside with King Jack yet, and it's clear that Jerry Allendorfer, Jerry really felt confident about him enough to put him at one point on a probable list for the Allen Jerkins. Ended up staying home and at Del Mar and running in the shared belief, but it seemed pretty evident, Mike, that this was a horse that Jerry and Dan felt had real talent. I mean, because to consider him for his third career start to run in a grade one, that's not something that Jerry would do lightly.
Yeah, this horse is a 2 year old. Really, really showed a lot of precocious talent, and so they were pretty excited about him as a 2 year old. And he had a little setback, and so we had to give him time. But when he came back, he really was always pretty forward and. And they were pretty excited about him, I think, all along. And so we did seriously consider going to the Jerkins, I think the final decision, Jerry thought in the final analysis it was probably smart, third out, as you say, to stay home and get that one under his belt. And unfortunately, we had kind of a rough trip in that race, but still he finished less than three lengths behind the horse that was the Derby and the Preakness favorite, so that's not anything to be too ashamed of. And so the race in Pennsylvania was something that we had kind of thought would made a lot of sense to cut him back and see what kind of a number he might put up and how he would compete. And we were, to say the least, we were really thrilled with how that went. Really exciting.
Now, he's interesting from a few standpoints because, the two turn race at Del Mar and the fact that, he would cut back to seven and in this case six, kind of shows that there's a lot that can be done with him and that the upside, I know after the race that the Malibu was talked about as the end of the year goal, but this is clearly a horse that can go two turns. I mean, there's a lot going on here. First of all, talk about, just the pleasure of you and Linda and Tom and for Jerry too. It's important, an important win, but just talk about watching the race and being able to enjoy it.
Yeah, well, it's just, for a horse guy, it just doesn't get much better than that. I mean, first of all, Parks just puts on such a, they just did such a wonderful job that day. It was a terrific day of racing. I mean, those $2 million races and the fields that they assembled for the entire day. So Parks did a terrific job, and they were so hospitable and nice to us. And then to be lucky enough to have a horse that was able to run a race like this. We've been in it a long time at a different level. And so it was thrilling. I mean, it's as good as it gets. I mean, that's just for an old dude that's been around it a long time. It was quite a thrill.
I went to Jerry to congratulate him, and he said I said, "What this is good, really great for you." And he said, "I'm not important." He said, "What this is terrific for is for Michael, who deserves as much success as can be delivered." And says a lot about Jerry. And I want to ask you, because I reached for McGreevy immediately after the really reprehensible treatment that Jerry received at the hands of the Stronach Group. And, you know, Tom came on literally the next morning and you know, said the kinds of things that, you know, most people would say about Jerry. From your side of things, Michael, standing by Jerry Hollendorf for some thoughts.
Well, you know, I followed Jerry's career a bit like I followed Tom's career prior to being associated with him. And I mean, everything that I ever heard about Jerry was that no one worked harder. No one was more honorable. You might not like everything, the way he delivers every message, but it's going to be the truth. Jerry's a very unusual guy. He's a terrific human being and a world-class horseman. You know, I've had over the years in partnerships and different deals, I've had horses with probably 20 different trainers, including two or three Hall of Famers also. And I can just tell you that in my opinion, Jerry is what the sport is all about. I mean, I get text messages from him at 3:30 or 4 o'clock in the morning his time, telling me that he's not going to take a horse to the racetrack because they jogged off a bit. Now, I'm not talking about not going to run a horse. I'm talking about not going to take him to the racetrack. So Jerry is a world-class guy. He's a world-class horseman. The industry needs more Jerry Hollendorfers. The situation in California, you know, I just hope that can all get resolved, because California needs Jerry Hollendorfer type people to promote the sport. You know, I've made the comment before that, and I believe this, that, I mean, I'm a small owner. I mean, I'm not we're not big players, but if there's not a place for a guy like Jerry Hollendorfer in California racing, then there's not a place for me. And I say that only because that is the things that have transpired out there, and I don't want to be political about it, but I mean, it's just it sort of doesn't pass the feel good test, and so hopefully they'll get it resolved. You know, I would like, you know, we have a number of horses in training with Jerry up there. We've not moved a single horse from Jerry. We stayed with him through the entire situation. Intend to continue. We'll continue to do that. But it's time for that to get resolved, and hopefully that will get resolved. But Jerry's just I don't know how he's devoted his entire life to the sport. Hall of Fame guy, 33,000 starts, 7,000. I mean, what do you say? I mean, you know, the record speaks for itself.
Oh, great, and appreciate the response, and you know, certainly hope that going forward here with King Jack, there's no complications on that front. The horses are here at the start of the Santa Anita season are going to run in Dan's name and Dan Ward. What about what's next? You've had now 3-4 days to kind of absorb it. What are the thoughts about King Jack's season?
Yeah, I think, you know, you have to see how everybody comes back and step back and be, you know, sober-headed about, you know, about what your options are. And we'll get our heads together here in the next few days and figure out what's next. But I think he's a horse with a lot of talent. I mean, he has, you know, he's got tactical speed, which, you know, I guess you can't take the Southwest out of me. I just love speed. You know, McGreevy says speed kills. So, you gotta have it. It's a dangerous weapon if you've got it. And so, you know, we'll just see what the next few weeks, show. But hopefully things will continue to be exciting for him.
Well, what's also got to be brought out, being by Jimmy Creed and out of the Tappet mare, and the fact that, you know, he performed the way he did around two turns and now cutting back, he's won at both seven and at six furlongs, delivers a 111 buyer on Saturday, which is, you know, second fastest of the year, and you know there's a lot to like going forward. And in terms of versatility, you know, with that pedigree and what he's already shown, who knows what you could do with him? And you know, and he was $100,000, and it's funny, among the 3 year olds, Michael, that are being campaigned, he was one of the smaller price tags amongst this group, right?
Well, he was of our group. He was the second least expensive, but I will tell you, I think he hit number 2532 or something like that. But Tom loved his horse the minute he saw him. I mean, he just said, you know, I'd already come back from Keeneland, and he said, you know, this is we need this. We've got to have this horse. And so he was convinced of that. But I think you're right. I think, you know, I think he's a horse that's potentially got some, you know, some versatility. And I don't know what the distance restriction will be, but we'll find out about that. But I, you know, he certainly didn't have a problem with two turns. And so we saw that he can sprint. So, you know, we'll keep our fingers crossed and see what's next.
You know, interestingly, too, he was the first foal out of the mare, Light Shine, the Tappet
right.
mare. And so there wasn't any track record. And, you know, some bloodstock agents won't buy a first foal. They want to see, you know, especially when dealing with a new client. And you would think that, right? You got to have a lot of confidence, right?
Yeah, now Tom is a very modest guy, but he is not short on confidence in his ability to pick a horse. You know, and I say that. I mean, so you got a young sire out of a first year unraced mare. You know, he would not be the first to fit in a category of you know, a racehorse coming from, you know, a young sire and an unproven mare. So Tom really, pedigree is far less important to him than the produce of the mare than it is the individual. I mean, he's a confirmation guy and he liked the parts. And so we bought him.
Well, and the results are out there on the racetrack. To the mare's credit, I don't want to shortchange Light Shine, because she is the sister. Well, Scrappy, for those of you that remember Fleet Alex, this is Scrappy T's little sister, and also Tar Heel Mom, the wonderful Tar Heel Mom.
It's a wonderful pedigree. I mean, it is. I mean, her first foal, so as you say, you know, a lot of people shy away from that, we didn't. And so, you know, the other thing is that from an affordability standpoint, sometimes, you know, buyers in our range, you have to make certain compromises from a pedigree standpoint in order to you know, get what you can afford. And
absolutely.
So that horse fits that category.
Speaking of which, too, I mean, how about the sale just ended? How'd you approach Keeneland this year?
You know, we were kind of silent this year at Keeneland. You know, we've got a lot of horses in training right now, so we'll see how they do. Basic Tipton's coming up. There's lots of horse sales, lots of horses. And candidly, I'm sort of watching the situation in California. It has affected me a little bit in terms of, as I mentioned a minute ago, there are things about that just don't feel right. And so, you know, I have a lot of, for us, we have a lot of horses in California percentage wise. And so, you know, I really want to see how that unfolds before we move forward too aggressively.
Understood. And this, you know, this fits, frankly, a lot of what we've talked about today. Mike Campbell joined us from Illinois, and we brought up the same kind of a scenario and how the uncertainty element has a very bad ramifications and a very bad trickle down effect on people's decisions that are trying to plan that are trying to manage their interest in the game.
Well, it really does. And I mean, for all of us who love the sport, we have enough challenges just from an attendance, from a handle, from a high altitude perspective. I mean, we've got a lot of challenges. There's a lot of entertainment competition out there now. And so we just can ill afford, in my opinion, unnecessary distractions and unnecessary problems that don't need to be dealt with. I mean, so I think that I just think we've got we got to get our house in order. And so, but it does. It affects. I'll be the first to say that it has affected my attitude about about. I'm 73 years old, and so I want to be smart about what I'm doing. And there are parts of what are going on out in California that don't make me feel real smart. So that's a part of the overall equation.
Well, and that's a message that that industry leaders, both nationally and regionally, should take to heart. Simply put, right? Yeah. Well, Michael, the good news is you got yourself one of the kinds of horses that you stepped up to the plate to acquire, and it was a delight to be there and see the satisfaction for you and Linda and for Tom and everybody. So King Jack goes forward. Who's King Jack named for, by the way?
Well, he's named after one of my best friends here in Fort Worth, whose first name is Jack, and the name of his business is King's. And so, and he's also named many, many years ago, another good friend of mine's grandfather's name was Jack, and he was probably the person that was responsible for me buying my first racehorse. So he owes me several $1 million. I'm pretty convinced of it. He's named after two people, but my good friend Jack here in Fort Worth is who he's named after.
Well, and I'm going to guess that Linda named Vermeer.
You got it. She named Vermeer. She did, yeah.
Well, see, this is dangerous. I'm going to warn you right now that Tina wants to know why I don't let her name any horses. And the answer is because if they don't pan out and you got to drop them down and dangle them and lose them to claim, you're going to – it's a danger in the household, Mike.
Well, I ran a quality road filly that was claimed about 6 months ago, and she was named after my youngest daughter, Molly McGee. So, I mean, it rarely pans out when they're named after people that are close to you and that are important to you. So King Jack is the exception. So let's just keep our fingers crossed.
Go with some inanimate objects and putting together. Sires and dams and
you gotta be real careful. Be careful what you wish for.
It's a slippery slope. But how's Dueling doing?
He is good. He's ready for a race. So we're just looking for something for him. And I asked Jerry if he thinks he's back like he was before surgery, and he says he thinks he is. So we're excited to have him back in action.
Nice. And in addition, over the weekend, Sentimental got her first board hit. That's the Honor Code filly. She was third, and so it looks like she's moving in the right direction. Probably run back at Santa Anita, mid October, and things are okay. It's already your best year in the game.
It's been a good year. Saturday was a good day, and it was really nice seeing you and sharing that moment down there with you. It was a terrific day.
And I appreciate you sharing your experience in the game and your insight with everybody listening. Michael Stinson, continued success, and we'll see you at Santa Anita.
Thanks, Dave. Always a pleasure.
Michael Stinson and Jerry Hollendorf, for Tom McGreevy, wife Linda, and everybody involved in the first graded stake win as an owner after, what do you say, 40 years. And really, seriously, only the last 10 years. And you know what? I should have asked it. I knew Dallas Fort Worth, but he's friendly with Joe Allen. If I asked him about his barbecue preference, he'd say Joe Allen's, because, you know, I've not been to Joe Allen's. I've been to Angelo's. And I got my first pair of boots across the street at Boot Town. Huh? You didn't wait. I got two pairs of boots. Absolutely. Take a break. John White's going to join us. We'll head out to California next.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
Amazing achievements for Pennsylvania breds on the world stage. Thanks to Finest City, Unique Bella, and Shamrock Rose, PA joins Kentucky as the only state in the past decade to breed Eclipse Award champions three straight years. Add that to our unmatched incentives. Plus, our Racehorse Development Fund can only be used to support PA breeding and racing. Why breed anywhere else? This is Brian Sanfratello. Go to PABred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Horsebills.com is a cost-effective, time-saving, paperless revolution. Vendors are able to generate electronic invoices for owners and other vendors who can pay through Horsebills.com for just 50 cents. Turn hours of work into minutes with our easy-to-use site. Have our team take over your bookkeeping or continue to do it yourself and pay only our low monthly subscription fee. Check out our video tutorial on the Horsebills.com YouTube channel and get started today for free. Horsebills.com. Toll-free number 888-938-4643.
Learn the business of horses in the world's only accredited equine business program, the University of Louisville Equine Business Program. The University of Louisville has a legacy of excellence for more than 25 years of equine business education. Classes are taught by industry experts in state-of-the-art facilities located in the heartland of America's equine industry. The University of Louisville Equine Business Program. When it comes to horses, we mean business. For more information, visit business.louisville.edu/equine.
Why is accreditation important in aftercare? The Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's standard of accreditation and grant process provide donors with confidence that their contributions are allocated in the most effective manner. TAA accreditation is only awarded after a complete review of an organization. Aftercare cannot be an afterthought for the industry. To learn more or support the TAA's mission, visit thoroughbredaftercare.org.
Hey, what?
Now, back to At the Races with Steve Vick on Sirius XM Radio.
California Soul. California Soul. California Soul.
We're back at the races. What a fun visit with Michael Stinson. I really appreciate Michael joining us. I was looking forward to it. And as I said, with the Pepper's Pride passing, there was a kind of an odd harmony there. And, you know, to hear that on Friday and then to win the first graded stake as an owner 24 hours later. Amazing. John White is going to join us, and John getting ready for opening day Friday at Santa Anita, and the Friday card certainly came together nicely, a great start, and that includes the two grade ones, the American Pharoah and the Chandelier. The boys race, particularly salty, and the Eddie D, and plenty of other action, and they'll put together the Rodeo Drive and the Awesome Again. I think, what else? The Unzip Me on Saturday and more. Plenty to look forward to. John White, good morning. No John White? No. Okay. He's not picking up, or because he acknowledged when I reached out to him early this morning. John's an early riser, and I just was confirming the visit. While we wait, I will mention that yesterday on Twitter, I was part of a group that was asked about a couple of Baffert three-year-olds, and two of them, in particular, Coliseum and Magic on Tap, that are very close to running. And in fact, Coliseum had entered and was scratched at Los Al last week. Magic on Tap turned up and has been working steadily at Santa Anita. Before that, had actually turned in three straight bullets at Del Mar. So Magic on Tap for Jane Lyon. This is the Tappet colt out of Aubie K that was a first out winner last summer. Right at the end of the meet at Del Mar, and then came back, won at the first start of the year at Del Mar in mid-August. So Magic on Tap being kind of spoon-fed a little bit. Baffert not rushing him back toward State Company, and this is just a one-mile first-level allowance. And looking at this group, a horse that we're very familiar with and we've talked about really since before he even debuted, Phil D'Amato and Michael House's Gumtree Lane, Gary Young bought at OBS last April. He drew the outside in this group, the seventh race. That starts the pick three? Yeah, the pick three. John White is now with us. There he is. Good morning, John.